Funding for Think comes from SMU Master of Liberal Studies programs.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. Where is the line between who we are and what we do? If you earn your living at something you are passionate about, something you feel compelled to do, you may find that line blurred or even invisible at times. MacArthur and Pulitzer Prize winner Lindsay Addario can speak to that sort of devotion to work. As a photojournalist for publications including The New York Times, National Geographic, and Time magazine, she has driven, hiked, and even parachuted her way into some of the world's most dangerous places, seeking the close-up human stories that might otherwise be lost in the chaos of conflict. She has been kidnapped twice, seriously injured in an automobile accident, and she has mourned the deaths of numerous photographic subjects, colleagues, and friends along the way. And she keeps going back. Lindsay Addario writes about the triumphs and the sacrifices of building her career in her new book, It's What I Do, A Photographer's Life of Love and War. She'll be in town this Friday, February 20th, to speak at the Dallas Museum of Art at 7 p.m. Lindsay, welcome to Think.
Thank you so much for having me.
You open the book with this story of being taken prisoner by Gaddafi's henchmen in Libya in 2011. And before it happened, you had been talking to your husband on the phone and saying you had a bad feeling about this particular trip. How often do you have that sense, and how do you decide whether to push past it or to yield to it?
Well, I don't have it all the time. I've had it 4 or 5 times in my that I can remember, and something has happened. But I remember on that morning, it was overwhelming. I mean, I really felt like something was going to happen. And in fact, either two days or one day before we were taken hostage by Gaddafi's soldiers, I had this premonition, and I turned to a colleague of mine, Brian Denton, who is a freelance photographer for The New York Times, and I handed him a hard drive of all of my images that I had shot to date. And I said, if something happens to me on the front line, can you please make sure you FedEx this hard drive to my agency? So I just had a feeling that it was coming.
When you do something like that, does that hard drive become like a talisman in some ways? Or is it strictly that you want to make sure the world has these pictures? Or do you think sort of in doing this, there's some kind of, I mean, I don't know if you're one to engage in any kind of magical thinking.
No, it's not a talisman. It's basically I'm here and I'm taking these photos and I want to make sure that if something happens to me, at least my images can survive.
On this trip, you ended up in a car with 3 other journalists, which is more than usual. For safety's sake, it's standard practice to sort of split up a bit when possible.
Correct. And also, it's often that 3 or 4 photographers from competing agencies or newspapers will get in the same car. But photographers, when we do that, we make sure that we have sort of the same level of fear and we want to all be at the front line. So even if we're competitors, we do it for safety. But it's rare that you have 2 photographers, a writer, and a video person all in one car. It is for safety's sake, but it's also just because we have such different needs.
Right. And somebody may need to be staying longer. Somebody needs to get on to the next location, that sort of thing.
Correct. And also, the photographers might want to be at the front line and the journalists might want to be at the hospital interviewing doctors, for example.
I love the story years before of your sort of big break when you were living in Argentina of getting this shot of Madonna, because it demonstrates that surprising sort of kindness that will sometimes bubble up even among people who are supposed to be competitors, and which I suppose has been repeated in some ways throughout your career.
Yeah, I feel like a lot of people have taken me under their wing throughout my career, and I'm so grateful. And I do think it's one of the professions, photojournalism, where you can have mentors and where people can take you under their wing. And it's the best way to learn, really. It's the best way to learn on the job. So in Argentina, when I was, I sort of got this challenge to photograph Madonna at the Casa Rosada in Buenos Aires, and she was filming Evita. And the newspaper that I was trying to work for said, if you can sneak on set and get a picture of Madonna, we'll give you a job. And I basically talked my way on set and in desperation. And I got onto the press riser, but I only had this tiny 50-millimeter lens. And the press riser was really far away, and I couldn't see anything. And so I sort of stood there and And I didn't know what to do. And this guy, a guy with like a 600 millimeter, said, "Hey, kid, give me your camera back." And I didn't even realize that Nikon cameras and Nikon lenses can be used interchangeably. And so I took my lens off and he put it on the back of his lens, which was like this hulking telescope, basically. And there was Madonna right there in my screen. And I got a job. So that was really great.
How did you develop the patience to just be with your subjects long enough that your camera no longer creates a sort of distraction or any self-consciousness?
Well, the first story that really taught me not necessarily the art of patience, but the necessity to just be patient if you want to be a good photojournalist was when I did the transgender prostitution community in New York. And I was working with the Associated Press in New York as a freelancer for about 3 years at that point. And they came to me and said, "Look, we have this project and there have been a series of murders in the transgender prostitution community. And we would like for you to sort of document what their lives are like and what it's like on the streets and anything that you can get, really." And so I went and I didn't even try to start shooting for weeks. And I would go and hang out with them every day and at night and just kept showing up basically like a puppy dog. And finally one of them said, it was Kima, and she said, "Hey, listen, show up at my house at 1 a.m. tonight in the projects in the Bronx and you can hang out with us." And that's when I really started shooting.
And there's an amazing self-discipline to just sort of waiting and observing, because I would imagine in the back of your mind as you were still developing at your craft, you must have thought, well, what if I miss something if I don't bring the gear with me tonight?
Well, I had my camera. I just kept it in my bag. Mm-hmm. So it is. I mean, I still have that fear. I've been shooting almost 20 years and covering war for 15. And I still have the fear that I'm going to miss this shot or not get any pictures. But it always pays off to be patient because people trust you more and they feel more comfortable with your presence as a photographer and also just as a person. And so it always pays off to be patient.
What do you remember about the first time you were outfitted for body armor?
Well, there is an email that I reproduced in the book, and it is basically I was being asked to send specific measurements for body armor, and I was in South Korea photographing a story on North Korean refugees, and my agency at the time, Corbis, sent me this request, "Can you fill this out for body armor?" because I was going to go into Iraq. And I looked at it, and it was terrifying. It was like, you know, the distance between your navel and your breasts and, you know, all these things that no one would ever know offhand. And so when I sort of sent him a very funny email that is in the book. And when I finally got into Iraq, I went into northern Iraq. I was carrying body armor. I was carrying a chemical suit because none of us knew if there would be a chemical attack. That was also a concern. And the first time one of my colleagues put the flak jacket on me, because I had no idea how to even put it on, I literally almost fell over. I mean, I was kind of knocked off my feet by how heavy it was.
You're very strong, but you're physically small.
I'm 5'1".
Yeah.
Yeah. 5'1", yeah.
I wonder how often, certainly there can be an advantage in certain parts of the world to going in as a woman who is not viewed as a threat. Will you talk a little bit about that and even about, you know, the idea that perhaps as tough as you are, that people don't immediately see you and think you are an imposing physical presence?
Yeah, I think many people ask me, isn't it a disadvantage to be a woman in a war zone? And for me, I'm so surprised because I think it's a great advantage to be a woman because, first of all, people look at me and I'm 5'1". When I started out, I was young. I'm not young anymore, but they sort of looked at me and said, "Oh, she's harmless." And I would get access to these places, I think, because people just underestimated me all the time and thought, you know, what could she produce? And it was actually great. On the front line, I think it doesn't matter if you're a man or a woman. What matters is whether you can move quickly, judge a situation, be able to flee if you need to, and just really work quickly. So honestly, it doesn't matter if you're a man or a woman. when I was embedded with the troops, it was a bit different because sometimes I would go on an embed to a really hostile area in Afghanistan or Iraq. And women, technically, according to the Defense Department, were not allowed on the front lines at that point. Those rules did not apply to journalists, but they applied to women soldiers. So it was rare for women to be in those situations. And inevitably, soldiers would sort of look at me like, oh, God, here comes a girl. And is she going to be able to keep up? And is she going to start crying when the bullets start flying? And, you know, so I always felt like I had to prove myself. And so I did every time. And you know, there was one time where I asked to be airlifted out. And that was after this very big ambush in the Korangal Valley during Operation Rock Avalanche with the 173rd Airborne. But I think, you know, I had spent almost 2 months in the valley and I had proven that I could hold my own and I just had had enough, really.
You were working for part of that time with a colleague who you knew to be pregnant. She wasn't telling anyone else.
Yes.
That's got to be, on the one hand, like this, you're thinking about yourself and your work and your colleague, and then there's this added level of concern for her well-being.
Yeah, I mean, she didn't ask me to take care of her. She
right.
certainly, she didn't, she took care of herself, and she was able to keep up, and she monitored her own how she was doing with her own health. So it wasn't necessarily my position to take care of her. But I, as a friend, obviously was concerned. But really, it was, she was in great physical condition and she was able to keep up.
Talk a little bit about how you process things that have been dangerous, things that you have witnessed that are just upsetting, and the need to, I mean, you have to feel them in the moment a little bit in order to photograph them effectively, but you can't allow yourself to be overwhelmed.
Well, I do allow myself to feel things in the moment, and I often will find myself crying as I photograph. And that, of course, becomes difficult if I'm trying to focus. it's very difficult to photograph while I'm crying, but sometimes I am overwhelmed. And the best, in the moment, I try and keep the camera to my eye so that I feel like there's a shield almost, or it's almost as if I'm watching a movie. And so it keeps me one step removed. After I experience something traumatic, I generally process it by talking about it very openly and almost excessively. I'll talk with my friends. I'll talk with my colleagues who were there with me or colleagues who have also covered conflict and my parents and my husband. And so for me, it's really one of the main ways that I deal with trauma and things that I've experienced is by processing it and talking about it. I'm not sure. Many people ask me, do you have PTSD? Do you suffer? I don't know the answer to that question. I think I'm okay, but one never knows with PTSD. Sometimes it resurfaces at odd times.
You have described sort of coming home to normal civilian life in the United States and sometimes feeling like it doesn't fit properly.
Yeah, I think when I first started covering conflict, for me, I had a very hard time reconciling the fact that I could be in Iraq in a gun battle and I can be watching troops getting injured and Iraqi civilians getting killed. And I would go home and no one seemed to care that there was actually a war going on. It seemed so completely the last thing on anyone's minds in the U.S. And so I don't know if that was a product of the fact that when I went home, I would often go to New York City. But for me, it was really tough.
We're speaking with photojournalist Lindsay Addario. Her new book is called It's What I Do, A Photographer's Life of Love and War. She'll be in town this Friday to speak at the Dallas Museum of Art at 7 o'clock. If you'd like to be part of our conversation, you can call 1-800-933-5372. You can email think@kera.org or send me a tweet at Chris Boyd Think.
The Funding for Think comes from SMU Master of Liberal Studies programs, accepting applications for summer and fall to design your own Master of Liberal Studies degree at SMU with concentrations in human rights, creative writing, and organizational dynamics. More at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We're speaking this hour with Lindsay Addario, a photojournalist for publications including The New York Times, National Geographic, and Time Magazine. Her new book is called It's What I Do, A Photographer's Life of Love and War. She'll be in town Friday, February 20th to speak at the Dallas Museum of Art. If you'd like to join our conversation, you can call 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org. Lindsay, a lot of your work requires you to photograph things that are just horrific. They are heartbreaking. They are painful. Why do you work to make them beautiful?
Well, I'm not sure I'm working to make them beautiful. I'm working to make a picture that will stop people and make them look and make them think and make them ask questions, because I think we are so inundated by images in today's world, and especially the digital world, and we're inundated by images of violence. And so for me, even if I'm in a very difficult situation or if I'm covering a war, I'll look for those quiet moments or, yes, sometimes beautiful moments to stop the reader and make them look.
How do you decide scale? Like when you're trying to convey a really big event, a really big moment, you can get really close or you can get far away and try to sort of capture everything. How do you make those decisions?
Well, generally, I'll try to do everything. I mean, if I'm covering an event, I'll try to get in close and get an overhead or get back and show the scale. So it really depends on how much flexibility of movement I have and who I'm working for and what the story is and what sort of hole I'm trying to fill in that story. So sometimes I'll have a lot of pictures that are in tight and up close and I'll need a picture that's pulled back.
There's a really striking photograph in the book of a little boy with bandages on his face, and his eyes are clearly filled with tears. And you fought to get that published and were unsuccessful initially. I mean, it's published in the book, but...
Correct. There's quite a long backstory to that photo. So basically, when Elizabeth Rubin and I were considering the story and trying to figure out how to tell the story, one of the issues we wanted to cover was the issue of civilian casualties and why so many Afghans were getting killed in the war. And we had such great technology. Our military had such incredible technology. Why did so many Afghans keep dying? And so we flew into the Korangal Valley in 2007. It was the fall of 2007, and really flew into one of the most dangerous places in Afghanistan at the time. And we started our journey in the Tactical Operations Center. It was sort of the command center for the Korangal Valley. And that night, one of the first few nights we were there, we were allowed in the room where they make decisions. They're monitoring combat going on. They're looking at troops in combat through drone feeds, heat-censored screens. It's incredible, the technology. And most of it was classified, so very difficult for me to photograph, but very very important for me to get a sense of what the situation was in the Korangal. So we were watching this battle go on one night, and there were troops pinned down, and there were Taliban or anti-coalition fighters fighting. And eventually the commander made a decision to drop a bomb on the Taliban because the troops couldn't get out. And so we asked to fly into that exact area the next morning because we wanted to see if there had been collateral damage. And the military, the 173rd Airborne, they were great. They had, they really believed in transparency. The command structure was incredible. They really let us dig our heels in and do the story properly. And so they flew us into that area. And when we arrived at the Korangal Outpost, which was the base, this family showed up. It was Khalid, this young boy that you're referring to. And he had scratches all over his face. His eyes were glassy. And it looked like he had been injured in shrapnel from a bomb. And so he was being treated by the medic. And the medic, while I photographed him, and after I said to the medic, does it look like his wounds are consistent with a bomb? And the medic, in very sort of military jargon, said, well, I can't confirm they're consistent with a bomb. So I wrote that in my caption with the intention of going back and fleshing it out later. But Elizabeth Rubin and I ended up spending almost 2 months in the Korangal Valley. And by the time we got out of there, we had been ambushed by the Taliban. Soldiers had been wounded and killed. And it was so much more dramatic, the stuff we had been seeing. So when I finally was filing the pictures, at this point, it was almost 4 months later, I sent in all these pictures. And I got a frantic call from my editor at the New York Times. And she said, the picture of Khalid is being considered as a cover, but your caption said he was not wounded his wounds were not consistent. And I said, no, that wasn't the case, basically. And I gave the whole backstory. And I said, it was pretty clear he was, but in war, there's ambiguity and there's no way to be 100% sure. But in my opinion, and in Elizabeth's opinion, and in Captain Kearney, who was the commander, everyone felt that he was probably wounded in that bomb. So I explained this. And the editor-in-chief wanted to know 100% for sure that he had been wounded. So he started discussing with the military public affairs officer. And of course, the public affairs officer is going to say, well, we cannot confirm that this person, because they don't want blood from Afghan civilians on their hands. And so it became sort of a he said, she said. And I said, look, like, you send us to war and you ask us to provide the facts. And these are the facts. You know, I made a mistake by writing the wrong thing in my caption, but that's crazy. And the editor in chief basically got so annoyed. And at the same time, the story shifted to a profile on Captain Kearney. And so he just pulled the photo from the layout. And he said, you know what? This photo will not run. And we will not even run a slideshow of your images to accompany the story, which in today's day and age, basically a slideshow is the only real estate any photographer gets, because there's so few pages and so many in magazines. So it really was upsetting, because I felt like my word was not being honored.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's speak on the phone with Peter in Denton. Hello, Peter.
Good afternoon. Wonderful show, as always.
Thank you.
My question is, with all the things there are to photograph, you know, nature and you know, people and lots of stuff, why did you choose conflict zones?
Shall I? Nature is beautiful. It's not my thing. I started photographing conflict almost. It wasn't my intention to be a war photographer. I was interested in the issues surrounding war, how war affected women, children, humanitarian crises. And I started doing it, and I realized that I was able to give a voice to people who did not have a voice. And I was able to transmit these messages to people of power and in positions of power to actually make change. And once I started doing that, and once my pictures started appearing on the cover of the New York Times and they could influence foreign policy, then it became impossible for me to go take pictures of flowers, because I felt like I was actually doing something with my work. So that is why. I mean, it's not, I think it's incredibly important to cover these things and for people to see what's happening.
Clearly, you are devoted to your work and you feel like it gives your life purpose. But along the way, through the years that you were really developing as a professional, you were keenly aware of the things that you couldn't have because of your devotion to this job.
Yes, and that was basically personal relationships. I mean, I tried for many years to have relationships when I would come home from a story or in between assignments, and it's not fair. I mean, it's not fair to the people I'm with, because my real passion and my real drive was allotted for my work. And so I would go off to Iraq and be there for 3 months at a time, or go to Afghanistan and go for 2 months and then come home and say, oh, I wonder where my boyfriend went. And so I think it's you know, it's only realistic for me to look back on it with some perspective. But it's really difficult to do this work and have any sort of personal life unless you're with a partner who fundamentally understands the drive and the need to actually be and do it.
You might think this is a strange thing for me to ask about, given all the very dramatic stories you tell. But you also write about, like, living in the New York Times house and sort of sharing quarters with fellow journalists. And I've wondered about, after you have these experiences and you come home after a day or a number of days out in the field, how you cope with the relative lack of privacy?
That's not a strange question. I like different questions. I actually find it comforting because there is an absence of familiarity in these places. And so anything like familiar faces, colleagues, that actually I found refreshing because I like to be able to talk about things and I like to have a good laugh at the end of the day if possible because a lot of what we're witnessing is so dramatic and so difficult. So it is nice to live in a house with colleagues. Granted, sometimes we need our privacy and you shut your door. I mean, it's very simple. You can go into, there were some people at the New York Times Bureau who would spend most of the time in their room and clearly they did not like communal living. I grew up in a very open household where the door was always open and people were always coming in and out. So I felt very comfortable with that.
Yeah, it's interesting what you tell us about your family background, because it's not as if you were raised in a situation that would have predicted your career, but you were raised in an environment where the door was not only always open, but lots of different people were welcome into your parents' home.
Correct. Both my parents are hairdressers. They still are. And they raised us with the philosophy that you should not judge people and accept people for who they are and not sort of open your arms to bad people. But if they're good people and their intentions are good, then certainly they were welcome in our home. And so often I would come home from school and I never knew who to expect to be sitting at the kitchen table. And it was sometimes there were transvestites, sometimes there were all sorts of people who were coming in and out of our house. And so we were raised with this really open philosophy. And I think that it's helped me in my career to go walk in and out of completely unexpected situations and really helped me to just not be judgmental.
When you were finally released in Libya after being abducted, you had to call people and sort of talk to them. And what's fascinating to me is that the thing you wanted to say to the people who love you is that you're sorry, which I'm not sure that would be the first thing to come to mind.
Well, I have to say that now I've been kidnapped twice. And the hardest thing about being kidnapped is that first phone call that I made to my parents, because I know at that point I must have put them through extreme pain and trauma. And I feel responsible. Of course, I feel sorry because I know that I've caused this pain with my professional decisions. And so for me, it's something that I have to live with. And, you know, what was, I think in both Iraq and Libya, those first phone calls are just the most difficult to make.
And it sounds like when you expect people to come down on you, they've actually been kind. And of course, they're happy to hear that you're alive. But you write about walking back into the newsroom at one point and not being quite sure what reception you would get.
Yeah, I didn't really expect it. You know, when we were captive, we had no contact with the outside world. I mean, we basically, for almost 7 days, we were completely isolated. And so we had no idea who was working on our behalf to get us released to you know, there were phone calls made from all corners of the globe, basically, to try and get us released, because there were four of us. It was Anthony Shadid, Steve Farrell, Tyler Hicks, and myself. And so there were a lot of people working to get us out. And so when we were released, we each took a few days to sort of decompress and be with our families. And then we flew to New York. And frankly, I hadn't really given it any thought how we would be received. I just sort of thought I would go into the newsroom like I always do. And I'm not staff, so I'm freelance. And some people know who I am, some people don't. And I'm always happy to see the people I know. But they had said to us, we're going to do some sort of reception. I don't remember the word they used, but I really didn't. I had no idea what to expect. And there was just this incredible, incredible outpouring of support. And they basically stopped the newsroom for about a half an hour to have the four of us talk about what had happened. And it was really emotional. I was crying the entire time. I mean, I broke down several times and it was really emotional. And I felt bad. I felt bad that that so many people had worked to get us out. I felt bad that I had inconvenienced people with our captivity. And so, yeah, there was a lot of sort of guilt about that.
But, of course, I have to imagine that if it were someone else, you would do anything in your power to ensure their safety.
Well, of course. Yeah. I mean, but it's not, you know, I don't think that I think or anyone thinks particularly logically after being held captive.
Yeah, yeah. How did you come to take an interest in the women of Afghanistan under the Taliban before 9/11, and how did that really position you? I don't want to sound calculating and cold about it, but it positioned you to really take a leading role in journalism that was taking place after 9/11.
Yeah. So I, in the late 90s, I was working in New York for the Associated Press. And in 2000, a family friend called me up and he said, I'm taking a group of students with Columbia University to India on a trip and you're more than welcome to come. And I was sort of itching to get overseas again. And so I said I would go along, and I sent out a bunch of emails before I left to editors, and I sent them cold and said, look, do you need a freelancer in New Delhi? And I got a few responses, and so I made the decision I would go on this trip and just stay there and live there and sort of give it a shot. And I rented a room from the Dow Jones bureau chief in New Delhi. And I was dirt poor and trying to make it as a freelancer. And he came back from a trip to Afghanistan because many of the South Asia correspondents at that time were covering Afghanistan under the Taliban pretty regularly if they could get visas. And there was a Taliban embassy, basically, in Islamabad that would issue visas to journalists. And so Ed came back from a trip and he had like 75 Afghan carpets. And he said to me, you know, you're a woman. You should live in you're a woman. You should go to Afghanistan and photograph how women live under the Taliban. And I honestly didn't think twice. I just thought that's a really good idea. All these journalists based in New Delhi are going. So clearly it's safe enough. Clearly the Taliban is welcoming journalists. And he gave me a bunch of contacts and I started sending emails and I went.
Lindsay Odario is my guest. She's a photojournalist for publications including The New York Times, National Geographic, and Time Magazine. She has a new memoir out called It's What I Do, A Photographer's Life of Love and War. And she'll be in town Friday, February 20th to speak at the Dallas Museum of Art. If you'd like to join our conversation, you can call 1-800-933-5372. You can email think@kera.org or send me a tweet at Chris Boyd Think.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Master of Liberal Studies programs. Accepting applications for summer and fall to design your own Master of Liberal Studies degree at SMU with concentrations in human rights, creative writing, and organizational dynamics. More at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We're speaking this hour with award-winning photojournalist Lindsay Odario about her memoir, It's What I Do, A Photographer's Life of Love and War. She'll be in town Friday to speak at the Dallas Museum of Art. You can join us at 1-800-933-5372 or email think@kera.org. Lindsay, when you go to a part of the world where you don't speak the language, I know often you'll try to find an interpreter or someone to work with, but are there pros and cons to understanding everything that is said around you or not understanding very much at all?
I mean, that's a good question, but I think if I had the choice, I would definitely learn the languages. I have been working in the Middle East for almost 15 years, and I would love to learn Arabic. I just haven't had the time. So I think there probably are pros and cons, especially, let's say, in Libya, when so much was being said around us when we were held captive, and it's probably a good thing I didn't know that they were threatening us every hour to execute us. But there were times when I would stop and ask Anthony if I didn't think we were scared to talk to each other, really, because we were tied up and part of the time we were blindfolded and we didn't know who was around. So often we were scared to even speak to each other. But there were a few occasions where I said, Anthony, what is going on? Because he spoke Arabic. And so he was able to translate. But sometimes it's a benefit to not understand.
There was a point at which one of your captors was sort of stroking you and saying something in a soft voice, and you thought he was saying one thing, and it turned out he was saying something very different.
Well, I didn't really know what he was saying. I had a feeling it was something sick, like threatening me, because there was a word he used, mord or something with that root, and I speak Italian and Spanish, and I thought that the word death was in there, but I was sitting in the back seat and I was tied up and I think I was blindfolded at that point. I was looking down and he was sort of caressing my cheek and very gently with his finger, just like touching my face and brushing my hair away from my face and repeatedly saying the same sentence. And finally, I said to Anthony, what is he saying? And he's saying, he will kill you tonight or you will die tonight. And so I just said, oh, here we go, you know. And I actually fell asleep at that point because I just thought, I mean, there is nothing else I can do, so I might as well just sleep, you know. So yeah, I fell asleep.
How much thought do you have to give to protecting your gear? I mean, obviously you care about your body, but you're carrying a lot of very expensive equipment, and if it gets destroyed, then maybe everything you've done is for naught anyway.
Yeah, I mean, a lot of people think I'm crazy that in the first few moments that we were taken, I was actually thinking about my cameras. I wondered if I would actually ever see them again. And it's, you know, when you're a photographer, your cameras are everything because it's sort of how we communicate and how we capture moments, and they are our tools and extensions of ourselves. And so for me, of course, I'm always worried about my cameras. At this point, I do realize I can replace them, and everything was stolen from us in Libya, including the shoes off my feet. But I think, and then I realized, of course, everything is replaceable, and that there are certain things that they can't take from you, like what's in my thoughts, you know. So that becomes even more powerful because they might take my physical things and my cameras, which are my tools, but they can't determine what I think, and they can't take away my hope to survive. So that was really important for me in that moment.
Do you ever have those moments where you think, I'm not doing this anymore? And how long does it take for those to go away and you're back at work?
Well, we had a moment of reckoning in Libya where the four of us were put in a prison cell in Sirte, which was Gaddafi's stronghold at the time. And they, fortunately, they put us in one cell together. And we were able to have this sort of moment of reckoning where we sort of went around the cell and said, like, are you going to do this again? Are you going to do this again? And it never – I knew I would be lying if I said that I will not do this anymore. And what happens every time I have brushes with death is that I think, how will I modify my work? How can I keep doing this work in a way that it can be powerful, but I don't necessarily have to be shot at and I won't get kidnapped again? Because I have a very dear friend named Dexter Filkins, who is a war correspondent. And he said to me once after Libya, I was asking whether I should go into Somalia. And he said, you know, man, you can get kidnapped twice and it's all right. You know, people understand. But you get kidnapped for a third time and everyone just thinks you're crazy. So I just thought, yeah, I guess you're right. So...
Do you think about, you have a young child now, have you written a letter in the event that something happens to you? Do you hope that, you know, he would understand if something were to happen to you?
Well, it helps that I just wrote a book, right? So I hope that he will read that book. I hope that after he reads that book, he will understand why I do this work. And that was one of the hopes for this book. You know, I think people have a real misconception about why people cover war and why people keep going to war. And everyone thinks it's for the adrenaline rush. And you do it for the adrenaline, right? And it's so beyond that. You know, that to me is really frustrating when people ask me that question, because they're not asking, like, you know, how important is that work? Do they, you know, when you look at the newspaper and you see firsthand what's happening around the world, you have to think, you know, there is a photographer behind every one of those pictures, and there is someone risking their life, and there is someone who is leaving their family behind. But we have to be more grateful for those images. You know, we have to say, look, these images are powerful and they shape our thinking.
Is it frustrating to you that your most powerful images certainly will have an impact on people, but they are, you know, floating in a sea of the thousands of images that people consume in an average day, week, year in 21st century America?
Sure. Yeah, definitely. But I just keep shooting and keep telling these stories, and I hope that people see them, and I hope that they affect people. And I'm always actually shocked when anyone knows who I am and when anyone does recognize my work, because I think, God, how do you know my work? Because I've been living abroad so long that I just sort of shoot and I send the pictures, and I hope that they make it and they are published in, you know, in a big spread or on the front page. And that doesn't always happen. So, you know, I'm always really shocked when anyone recognizes my work.
Talk about the importance of context and what you do to be sure that a photograph is presented in whatever publication in a way that allows people to understand what it is that you're showing.
Well, I think it is important to work for publications that I trust. And I think that that is the best way I can really answer that, because some publications I get nervous, or I would get nervous, that maybe they will, the caption won't be comprehensive. And the caption is the few sentences that go beneath the photo to explain what's happening. Or I don't want my pictures taken out of context. I don't want people to assume something is happening that's not happening. So I'm very careful about who I work for, because that means so much to me. And so I work for the New York Times, National Geographic, Time, where I am involved in that process, and I can be sure that they won't sensationalize the photos.
You write about over time coming upon similar situations, you know, time and again, and beginning to really kind of think about different ways that you could show things. There are photographs that you have sort of allowed the image deliberately to be blurred. Can you talk about how that maybe gets to a kind of truth that a crystal clear image of the same event might not?
Well, I think I'm always struggling with how to make a different picture. And when you think about the sheer number of images that are out there and the number of photojournalists out there, almost every story has been told before, and they continue to be told. And so it's always a challenge to get something different and, again, to engage the reader. And so for me, when I was working a lot in Darfur, for example, and that's a place where I started experimenting with shooting out of focus a little bit, or making sort of almost fine art images of a scene that I had shot so many times before. And what I'll do in that situation is actually shoot frames in focus and shoot the scene as a documentary photographer. And then I'll sort of spend the extra time to make different images, because sometimes it's those different images that the reader is attracted to, or they end up in a gallery, and then maybe I've touched or I've educated a whole new group of people, people that don't read the New York Times or people who don't read the newspaper. And so it's important for me to engage as many different forms as I can with the work, because I want it out there.
When life and death safety is not an issue, which would sort of dictate when you have to take off from a scene, how do you decide when you're finished?
I never feel finished. I always feel like I don't have enough. And so I'm pretty tortured when I'm shooting. I feel like I'm not getting the right picture, and that the composition isn't right or the light isn't good. But I basically... I don't get sent on assignment for really long periods of time anymore, because no one has those budgets. So I have to think about what I need to tell the story, and I'll do the best job I can in a certain amount of time, because I have to move around and get a variety of coverage.
Does your work find its way into your dreams, like the dreams you have while you were sleeping at night?
Well, I have to say, since I've been on book tour, I've basically had a nightmare that I'm getting kidnapped by ISIS every night.
Really?
Because I keep talking about Libya.
Yeah.
So I think, you know, generally, no. I have no idea where generally, no, I don't dream about what I shoot. I certainly don't dream about it when I'm in the place where I'm shooting. Sometimes when I come home, I have some dreams, but I don't dream about it when I'm there.
How much do you worry about ISIS?
A lot. I worry about ISIS a lot. I think I don't think they're going away anytime soon, and I worry about how journalists have been targeted and killed, and I worry about how I can keep continuing to cover the countries in their proximity without getting kidnapped.
When you look back over your work, I mean, is it all sort of digitally preserved? If you wanted to look back over the last 15 years of what you have done, what formats is it in?
Well, I'm laughing because I'm a disaster. I'm like the least organized person on the planet.
Like shoeboxes?
So I basically have a box of about 55 hard drives, and that's where the last 15 years of work is. And actually, when I first started shooting digital, I had no system of archiving, and I didn't back things up. So there are entire bodies of work that I can't find, that I only have in low resolution. And so I'm trying really hard to be organized. I have this great woman who has worked with me for many years, who is now a photographer. Her name is Monique Jacques. And she, when she was in college, she started working with me. And I basically go to her and say, where are these photos? And she generally knows more than I do.
If you were advising somebody who had studied and worked hard and was sort of professionally ready, but had not yet been to a war zone to photograph, what would you suggest they pay the closest attention to?
I would say don't go to Syria to cut your teeth. I think that the world has changed. You know, I cut my teeth in Afghanistan under the Taliban, but they were giving visas to journalists and they were welcoming journalists. So I think a mistake a lot of young people are making is going right into Syria, and the kidnapping rate is very high. So I would say try and find maybe a conflict where journalists are not targeted and link up with someone who has experience and go with them. Don't try and go alone. Don't try and, make your way through a war zone without someone who can really school you on how to cover war, because there are people out there. There are people with a lot of experience who are happy to take someone along with less experience and just teach them. You know, that's something that we all need to take responsibility for younger photographers and help them, because it's become too dangerous.
What kind of future do you see for yourself?
For myself?
Well, yeah.
Well, I have a 3-year-old son, so I hope to spend time with him and to keep working and to keep telling these stories.
Is there a particular place you want to go that maybe you haven't focused on before?
No, they're just the same sort of stories I want to keep shooting. I do feel like I am very comfortable and very happy, and there's so much material to cover in the Middle East and Africa and in South Asia. And I do many, many stories every year and try to spend time on those stories.
Lindsay Addario is a photojournalist for publications including The New York Times, National Geographic, and Time Magazine, and she is a winner of the Pulitzer and MacArthur Prizes. Her new book is called It's What I Do, A Photographer's Life of Love and War. She'll be in town Friday, February 20th to speak at the Dallas Museum of Art. Lindsay, I so appreciate the time you've made for us. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much for having me.
Think is produced by Stephen Becker and engineered by Shelley Canavy. Lindsay Connect is associate producer. Jeff Whittington is executive producer. You can find me on Twitter at Chris Boyd Think, and if you'd like to email the show, you can send that to think@kera.org. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening, and have a great day.